the bees pollinate, which makes like lettuce and stuff. Mm-hmm. So the farmers could sell it so they can make money. And the bees do the same. And while they're at it, they eat the food.
The bees are the same?
Yeah.
They also want to sell their honey.
And yeah. But they can't. Because the $1 bill is bigger than their whole head.
That's true.
Welcome to We Are Nature, a podcast about natural histories and livable futures presented by the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. I'm your host, Michael Pisano, and today we're talking just a smidge about food, a little bit about faith, a lot of bit about bugs, and about how cultivating empathy for lives that don't resemble yours is an essential foundation of climate action. Back in the summertime, we sent field reporter D.I. Batad to visit Garfield Community Farm, a 2-ish acre urban farm in Pittsburgh's Garfield neighborhood. The farm's focus on regeneration, education, and community access is helping create loving connections between people and non-human life. It's also a meaningful asset to Garfield's resilience to the changing climate. All that, plus a big dose of arthropod natural history, and more on today's episode. Stick with us.
My name is AJ Monsma. I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator at Garfield Community Farm. I live a block away, and I've been here since 2014.
What made you interested in being involved with the farm?
So I, after college, went to Rwanda with Peace Corps, and I loved it. I lived with nuns in this Catholic compound, and they were incredible. And I got started with food security and agriculture in Rwanda. And I ended up staying another year because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I came back yet. And then my third year, I worked with a group of street kids and did like kitchen gardens and enjoyed it so much that I knew when I came back, that's what I wanted to do. And at first I thought, oh, I'll just study agriculture, horticulture, something along that. But the more I talked with folks and thought about it, the piece I really liked was how the kids just really came together and got really cohesive around this food project. And I wanted to go into some sort of community building, conflict res, schooling, but then surrounded with about food. So Garfield Community Farm was kind of a marriage of both those things. I had a friend who knew about it, told me about it, and it was something that I could do community building around food, centered around food.
Awesome. And so for someone who's never heard of the Garfield Community Farm, can you give a brief overview?
Yeah, Garfield Community Farms is a little over 2 acres in almost the top of Garfield neighborhood. And it's great because Garfield neighborhood historically was a very agricultural neighborhood. So if you're walking around, you still see remnants of apple trees and gardens. And there's just a really strong history of that in this neighborhood. So when Garfield Community Farms first came here, this land was just torn down housing and it was very desolate. And it was an intentional choice to show folks what can happen if you steward a place faithfully over the years and restoring health. And I love that that's our beginning because that's what we try to do with people, with land, with our relationship with food, with each other, and with the earth is just that restoration. So Garfield Community Farm physically is a place where we want that to happen on many levels, that piece of restoration and healing.
Great. And what is the mission?
The mission of Garfield Community Farm is, along with our neighbors, to grow food and to learn about food and the earth. And there's 3 big parts of that mission. So there's the education piece, there's the actual growing food and distribution piece, and then the 3rd piece is actually very much related to how this was started under a church. And to show that through stewardship, God can really restore health to a place that was not in good shape when you got there.
Yeah. Can you talk about how this work aligns with your faith?
How this aligns with my faith? Yeah, definitely. So the farm itself started as a ministry of a church, Open Door Presbyterian Church, who intentionally didn't want to buy a building. They wanted their money going towards something else than just a building. and they wanted to pour money into the farm. And Faith was behind that, and one, again, choosing that space that was desolate and not just picking a flat place with beautiful soil, and to example how God can restore. And then in having a permaculture approach, which is a word I don't love because it has a lot of white colonial strings attached to it, but we are a permaculture farm. The thing that's great about permaculture are those three core ethics. So it's people care, earth care, and fair share. So when we look at our resources, when we look at our people, when we look at our food, we want that to be equitably distributed among those things, which very much lines up with faith. We're not here just to grow food and hand it out. We're not here just to like have fun events. We're here really for that healing and restoration in a very holistic way, which is all about the story of God and Jesus and the faith story through the Bible.
Yeah, and along those lines, what are some of the ethics that guide your work?
So permaculture-wise, of those ethics of people care, fair share, and earth care, are to leave the space in a better position, better shape than when you came here. It's kind of in every interaction with people, with earth, with animals, you want it to be better, to leave better for both those parties to leave better. And so it's honoring all of those things. And then being intentional, like when we look at our budget, and when we look at where our time is spent, just asking us those hard questions of, are we putting too much of ourselves into one thing and not being fair to another thing? So just that equity is really important with ethics. And then the faith side of that is just having this place be a place where everyone feels safe, no matter where they're coming from, whether that's physically, mentally, spiritually, but they know they can be here and find sanctuary, whatever sanctuary means to them. And a lot of that for us, I think, has been at this point kind of stepping back in certain ways so that folks can fill in the space how they need to fill it in. And that's helped us, I think, stay an asset to the community. And each year it's kind of growing in that way.
Many cultures and faiths all across the world practice devotional care of the land. Many explicitly recognize and revere the divine within every single living being. I personally love knowing that right across town, AJ and her friends at Garfield Community Farms are finding fellowship in remediating and caring for our land. And to me, Garfield Community Farms' mission speaks to hope for the future. I don't share every aspect of their faith, but I don't feel excluded from their space or their mission either. Their inclusivity is an important reminder about working together. It can be easy to fall into infighting along religious or political or other partisan lines, and that infighting is a very real threat to the entire planet. There is just so much that keeps us divided. Every moment spent arguing with or avoiding people who are on some perceived other side is a lost moment to mitigate and prepare for climate change. We need every moment. Personally, I find spiritual fulfillment and fellowship being immersed in the forest. The feeling of walking under trees, being surrounded by innumerable living things, that is absolutely sacred to me. The more time I spend out in the woods, the more I'm inspired to learn about the world. And the more I learn, the less I perceive the barriers separating me and other earthlings. Those moments of immersion and interconnection offer me peace and awe and purpose, and that spiritual nourishment feeds my own faith in the future. Now, in a very literal way, climate breakdown is coming to sack my temple. And whatever your religion, politics, or relationship to nature, it's coming for your temples too. Because all the temples are here on this one planet that we all share. In mitigating climate breakdown and building resilience against the inevitable changes, we care for each other. Humanity is plagued by isolation and division. A great shared defense of the temple would bring us back together. And a very real part of that, which we must attend to now, is reviving the land that keeps us.
Can you tell me about how the farms have been restoring land to the community?
Yeah. So, again, so this was all housing that was torn down. In Pittsburgh, that's just collapsing the building into the basement and then throwing like an inch of dirt on top. So when we first came to this space, it was just all invasives and nothing really good was growing. And there was a lot of rubble. So in just that very basic sense of restoring the land, the first couple years was just hauling things out and then bringing in compost and manure and building up healthy topsoil. And so now in certain areas of the farm, we'll have like a foot or more of healthy topsoil. And as we've done that and we've brought in like native plants, but also native plants were just kind of waiting for the conditions to be better and have come up. So there's a lot healthier biodiversity, which for people, one, just aesthetically being here and seeing the diversity of flowers, of birds, of pollinators is just such a peaceful thing and can be really filling spiritually and emotionally. And then just for the space, like we, one of our staff members is really into birds. So he can tell you like after, you know, 3 years of doing this work was the first time he saw like a scarlet bunting, which is a migratory bird, stop here, you know, on its migration. Cause we finally had enough like biodiversity for the bird to want to stop here. So restoring the health to that place. And then I've noticed, like when I work with kids or other people coming up here, they just don't feel like they're in a city, you know, so they maybe they don't have any land where they are. They're just an apartment or another place where they've not grown stuff. So to be here and to see all the different plants and just the wonder and the awe that brings to them, it just kind of takes you to a different spot, which is really special. Yeah.
Absolutely. Can you talk about, you mentioned soil health. Can you talk about what that is and why that's important?
Yeah, soil health is like the foundation if you want to grow anything good. And so in Pittsburgh, soil health in Pittsburgh, I mean, I've heard there's a lot of heavy metals, especially lead in the soil. So one, there's a lot of remediation that has to happen. So before you even put anything in the ground, you have to test your soil. And that's seeing if there's harmful things in there, but seeing what the beneficial things in there as well. Yeah, so soil health is the foundation for all health and all food. And it's something that we do a lot with the kids because it's fun to look at just the structure of soil health and what part the bugs play and the worms play. But the fungus inside of there and the bacteria and all those living things, which is why compost is very important and something we take seriously here. And we get compost donations from other people in the city and are always putting compost back in the earth and those living things back in the earth. But it's very diverse. And so I'm a little biased against aquaponics and hydroponics because they don't capture like everything that's actually in soil, but building healthy soil is the, I guess, easiest way to guarantee that you're going to have like nutritionally robust food, and healthy, happy things. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. On the site too, it talks about ecological design and how it can contribute to biodiversity.
Yeah. Yeah, so I can speak, so that's in, I guess, with permaculture too, in that design piece. And it's just mimicking how indigenous groups planted, you know, a long time ago of let's look and see what works and then try to, you know, do agriculture in that way. And so being intentional about design, working with what you have. So we're on a site that no traditional farmer would have picked to like farm on because it's a hill, because of all the clay in the soil, because of all the rubble in the soil, so many things, all the invasives. But you work with what you have. And so part of that design piece is, hey, we're on a hill. There's ways that you can farm at a hill to prevent erosion, to keep most of those minerals and nutrients intact. So doing things like berm and swale beds, doing things like terraces. It's trying to restructure and use what resources you have so that you don't have to bring in a lot. And that's an approach here is just trying to create those closed systems, which exist naturally. Like no one goes into a beautiful like forest and messes with it so that it keeps existing. So it's trying to create those closed systems that take care of themselves. And if you do that well, and the biodiversity that results from that, that also helps kind of continue that. So the more diverse flowers you have, the more diverse pollinators, the more birds that are coming in. And so you get that cycle of your good bugs that are going to get your bad bugs and all of that. And so I've been here now 5 years. And each year is different with bugs. And we get certain bugs, like harlequin beetles were really bad this year. But overall, like as the biodiversity is increasing, we're seeing things kind of balance each other out. So when we do, you know, my first couple years, maybe aphids were really bad outside, but now it's like not a problem at all outside, but maybe only in like one of our indoor spaces. So things like that, as you let, you kind of give nature what it needs to then do its own thing, and just kind of sit back and let that happen and prune out stuff that's going to hinder that, but just kind of let it organically grow. And that's kind of gone over to how we've interacted with community and people too, is just, here's the space. How do you want to use it? And just kind of sit back and kind of see and monitor what happens.
Really quick sidebar.
Yeah.
What are those, I think they're black and bright orange little bugs that look like, they're shaped like stink bugs.
It's the harlequin beetles.
Those are the harlequin beetles.
They're terrible this year.
Yeah.
They're terrible this year. And we even got them on our like mustards and lettuce, which we've never had. They're always on our kale and collards. And we're an organic farm. So like we don't use, everything we use is organic. And we, there's like one spray, Captain Jack's like dead bug brew that is somewhat effective, but like you just kind of like have to hand pick them. So they were really bad this year.
Yeah.
And with like, I've heard, because our poison ivy is getting really bad, like certain things. And I've talked to some people who've told me anecdotally it's because of climate change. So I'd have to like look more into that. But like with climate change, with more rain, like those things are shifting. And like things aren't doing what they have done, you know, in the past. So you have to like be resilient and kind of know those things and adapt.
Right.
Yeah. So bugs are going to change like as the climate changes, among many other things. But mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure.
Bugs are indeed changing along with the climate. First, to AJ's point about pests, several recent studies have confirmed that warming temperatures and more precipitation increase the populations, ranges, and metabolisms of agricultural pests like aphids, locusts, whiteflies, and corn earworms. We can see it in the fossil record from past periods of global warming, and we can see it happening in real time on farms all around the world today. This proliferating pest problem is absolutely linked to climate. But ultimately, the boom in agricultural pests is a symptom of outdated human agricultural practices. Say it with me, monocultures stink. Huge monocultures are susceptible to huge infestations in ways that smaller, distributed polyculture systems are not. The global movement of food and material and people is what introduces invasive pests. And introduced pests can spread and multiply aggressively in new environments. And replacing native plant communities with crop monocultures or other monocultures like manicured grassland hurts native animals' ability to compete with and munch on agricultural pests. This is partly why Garfield Community Farm's approach to regenerating land to support healthy soil and diverse native plants is really impactful. It creates much-needed habitat. The farm also gives people the chance to experience bugs firsthand. When bugs are in the news, it's pretty much always news about infestation or disease or pestilence. You almost certainly heard about that 100 square mile locust swarm that devastated crops across the Horn of Africa in 2020. Stories that feature bugs are more likely to paint them as a plague than as partners. But that's only a very small part of a much more complicated story of interrelationship and interdependence between bugs and people and pretty much every other living thing on the planet. Bugs are so diverse. We have named 1 million insect species, and the latest models suggest that there might be another 6 million waiting to be discovered. That doesn't count spiders, mites, worms, snails, springtails, millipedes, centipedes, and other small terrestrial invertebrate friends that I'm lumping into the bug category. Altogether, bugs make up most of the diversity of animal species on Earth. By the way, of those 1 million known species of insect, only 1 to 3-ish% of them are considered pests. Bugs have been around for a long time. Examining the fossil record, the first terrestrial arthropods came out of the ocean to start colonizing land at least 500 million years ago. It's around the same time that we observed the first mosses and lichens leaving the water. During those 500 million years, bugs have built deep relationships with other organisms. Bugs and plants rely on one another, they work together. Same with bugs and fungi, bugs and microbes. The natural world, including us, rely on those collaborations. The incredible and myriad symbiotic relationships between our tiny bug neighbors and those plants, fungi, bacteria, are what turn detritus into fertile soil. They directly feed fish, birds, reptiles, humans, and generally provide the foundation of our food web. That brings us to how our so-called good bugs are being affected by climate change. In short, many, many bugs are in trouble. Populations and local species diversity have been declining for years, especially in places with heavy industrial agriculture. Clearing land, spraying huge amounts of pesticides, it's all taken its toll. Now, the speed of the changing climate is also forcing bugs out of their native ranges. It's also messing up their life cycles. It's displacing and destroying populations of plants, fungi, and other organisms that insects rely on, they have obligate relationships with. The declines in many species are so bad that some scientists are calling it the insect apocalypse, or insectageddon. Whatever you call it, the problems with bugs are problems for us. Destabilizing all those intricate interrelationships that took hundreds of millions of years to put together, that puts our ecosystems in danger of collapse. Real danger. This is an essential problem to solve to keep our landscapes and our food system stable. It's also a moral imperative. We have to save as much biodiversity as possible from extinction at the hands of climate breakdown and archaic human industries. Biodiversity is essential to human resilience to climate change. Biodiversity is also essential to our quality of life. Preserving it is a commitment to the intrinsic value of living things. To save biodiversity and to save our souls, we have to save our neighbors in the undergrowth. So what do? How do we save bugs? Well, alongside the material solutions like cultivating insect habitat, which we'll talk about, there is also a need to cultivate a better relationship with bugs. And that can start in a place like Garfield Community Farm.
Introduce yourself. What's your name and how old are you?
I am Israel and I just turned 10.
Just turned 10, and where are we?
We are at the Garfield Community Farm.
Can you tell me about this place?
It is very natural, mm-hmm. Cool. The food is delicious. And there's a lot of bees and animals.
So the first time you came to this farm, what do you remember seeing?
Flowers.
You remember how you felt?
Scared of bees.
I am a complete and total and unabashed bug nerd. I love bugs. I can trace my whole kind of interest in science back to an ant colony in my parents' backyard. And yet, even I understand and relate to the visceral fear of bugs. Most of us probably remember our first bee sting or our first fire ant bite. I'm still liable to let out a little yelp when just an unexpected flying friend lands somewhere on my body. Bugs are undeniably alien, strange, sometimes threatening, but I think it's incredibly important to learn to see beyond that, to see them as more than that, to learn about what they do for us, and to learn from them about resilience and interconnectedness. It's important to see life at other scales besides your scale, to imagine experiences outside of your own experience. We have to care about each other. And when we say each other, I think that has to reach beyond the easy boundaries. In my experience, firsthand exposure to a busy patch of flowers can go a long way in the right direction.
That's the bee I pet when I was here. Hi,
yeah,
Tommy.
Bees are pretty nice.
Mm-hmm. His name is Tommy.
Oh, that's Tommy the bee, huh? So the first time you came to this farm, you were scared of bees?
Yes.
And now you're petting bees?
Yes.
How did that happen?
I learned if you if you're not afraid of the bee, if you're not afraid of the bee won't be afraid of you.
Why are bees important? You seem to know a lot about
pollination, honey. They're part of the food chain. They give us good stuff, like more flower species and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And honey.
Yeah. Why is pollination important?
So they could keep bees alive.
Mm-hmm. Do you have more flowers?
Yeah. It's not a farm without flowers, right?
The first flowers were underwhelming. They weren't big, they weren't that colorful, there weren't a whole lot of them. Sometime in the Cretaceous, flowering plant diversity exploded. They became brighter, more colorful, larger, more fragrant. While flowers likely predate the Cretaceous, the fossil record shows an unprecedented boom in their spread and diversity. And this starts around when we think bees appeared. Now, beetles and other animals were pollinating plants on a smaller scale before the Cretaceous. What's unique about bees is that they specialized as pollinators. They became so effective that flowering plants radiated and prospered. Today, there are more types of flowering plant than any other plant group, with over 350,000 known species. That's around 90% of the world's known plants, and of those, 3/4 are pollinated by insects. The majority of pollination is done by bees, but not just honeybees. No, there are over 20,000 species of bee in the world. And most pollination is done by wild native species, like carpenter bees, bumblebees, and sweat bees. Birds, bats, butterflies, beetles, ants, other animals act as important pollinators too, but hold on a minute, we'll leave that for another time. You might think of bees as social animals, but many don't ever see the inside of a hive. In fact, less than 15% of bees live in colonies. The rest are largely solitary, meaning that they spend their lives alone or in small, semi-cooperative groups. Regardless, most bee species embrace the same general lifestyle. Female bees lay eggs in a nest. They stock it with pollen and nectar, and then wall the thing up so their young will have a safe place to grow. This is similar to wasps, almost all of whom are predators, though many wasps will also eat protein-rich pollen or sweet nectar. Their shared behavior gives us a clue to bees' origins. We think bees branched away from the wasp family tree around 130 million years ago, during the Cretaceous. The basic idea is that wasps were hunting prey on plants, and some of that prey had pollen stuck to it. And it turns out that much like a spider or a caterpillar or another common wasp snack, pollen is rich in protein. It makes a great substitute food for developing young wasps when prey is scarce. So, gradually, some of these wasps evolved to fully feed their kids on pollen. Before insect pollination, plants reproduced and spread their pollen through wind dispersal. Crops like corn, wheat, rice, as well as many trees, still do this today. But for many plants, wind dispersal is not a very effective way to reproduce. The first pollinating insects were probably snails or beetles that ate pollen. And by visiting multiple flowers, these bugs would have fertilized plants. This little collaboration was so much more reliable than hoping the wind would blow pollen to and fro the right spot, that somewhere along the way, flowers started evolving traits to become more attractive to pollinating insects. This competition drove the specialized adaptation of bees, including hairy bodies and little baskets on their legs to collect pollen, longer tongues to reach nectar deep inside plants, and behaviors like honey production to preserve nectar and pollen over winter. Over millions of years, plants and pollinators continued co-evolving for mutual success. The resulting boom in flowers really changed the game. It deepened the relationships between bugs, plants, and other organisms. I mean, for example, there's a species of mite that live in a special structure of hairs on some bees' bodies. The mites hitch a ride from flower to flower where they eat a fungus that can attack pollen. The mutualisms go deep, and countless small interrelationships like this arguably form the foundation of every ecosystem.
What about people? Are they good for people?
Yes. The bees pollinate, which makes like lettuce and stuff. Mm-hmm. So the farmers could sell it so they can make money. And the bees are the same. And while they're at it, they eat the food.
The bees are the same?
Yeah.
They also want to sell their honey and make money?
Yeah. But they can't. Because the $1 bill is bigger than their whole head.
That's true.
Our food system is reliant on bugs. 1 in 3 bites of food that we eat on any given day was pollinated by an insect. Other bugs eat pests and fungi that attack crops and livestock. Bugs are essential to turning waste into healthy soil. And bugs feed birds and other organisms that help spread seeds, fertilize fields, and otherwise fill a niche in a healthy, food-bearing habitat. So yeah, we rely on bugs. Increasingly, their future relies on us. How do we return the many favors that bugs do for humans, and simultaneously keep our food and ecosystems resilient against climate breakdown? First up, we've got to change the ways we grow food. We've talked about industrial monoculture a lot this season, particularly during the episodes called Carbon and Cattle and Food is Nature, so go check those out if you haven't. The short version is that a huge waving field of corn or soy destroys and fragments habitat. Monoculture destroys the soil with chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and these huge fields are inviting to big populations of diseases and invasive pests. Big agribusiness operations run on petroleum, they emit crazy amounts of greenhouse gases like nitrous oxide and methane, and as we've seen during the last 3 years, pandemic, war, and natural disaster, the monoculture-based food system is vulnerable in ways that make food more expensive and more scarce. By contrast, smaller polyculture setups like Garfield Community Farm can more easily regenerate soil and habitat and food for bugs. They can sequester carbon in the ground. They can avoid harmful fertilizing and pesticide practices. They help connect people to their food and help people connect human health to healthy food to a healthy environment.
Yeah.
So, do you think this farm is a good thing?
Yeah.
Why do you think it's a good thing?
Because it provides places to eat. And there's animals. They keep the animals well fed. They're keeping flower species alive, I guess.
That sounds good. That sounds like it's a good thing. What's your favorite thing that you've done here at the farm?
Eat.
So there's food here?
Yeah. Well, you make the food from the farm.
Did you learn how to cook here?
Yes.
You did? Do you cook at home now?
Yes.
You do all the cooking?
Only when my mom needs me to. I've made chicken for my mom and my brother and my sister.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't learn how to cook until like last year.
Do you know how to cook hot dogs? They're really easy.
I'm pretty sure I know how to cook hot dogs. And then do you cook things that they grow here?
Yeah.
Do you remember your favorite thing to cook here?
The garlic thing, as AJ said.
Oh, pesto.
Yeah,
pesto.
Garlic pesto.
I love making pesto.
It made my breath stink, but it was good.
Awesome. That's definitely true. So, what would you say to someone who's never heard of this place, didn't know this existed?
That they should check it out.
Why should they check it out?
Because it's pretty darn cool.
It's pretty cool. Why would you say it's pretty cool?
look around, nature.
Yeah.
Food that provides nature. I mean, nature that provides food.
So supporting a shift away from monoculture-based agriculture via policy change, via redirection of subsidies, and supporting decentralized climate-smart agriculture would be huge in supporting bugs and people. It's time to get loud and let your politicians and your policymakers and your neighbors and your coworkers and your local grocery store let everybody know. The solutions to our broken food system exist, and we want to invest in them. We will get back to AJ and the sweet summery sounds of Garfield Community Farm in just a moment. One more aside first about another monoculture that harms bugs, the grass lawn. A NASA study concluded that almost 80,000 square miles of American land is devoted to turf lawns. Grass takes up more real estate than any individual food crop. Not only is grass lawn crummy habitat for bugs and native biodiversity, it also requires lots of fertilizer and pesticide and gas-powered machinery for upkeep. American homeowners are estimated to use 10 times more fertilizer and pesticide per acre than the average farm. Gas-powered lawnmowers produce way more emissions than gas-powered cars. As with agricultural monoculture, the grass lawn is bad for biodiversity and bad for the climate. So, if you've got some sort of control over some grass-covered space, look into alternatives. There's tons of great regional guides to bug-friendly groundskeeping. And while landscaping isn't going to save the world on its own, I think it has a part to play. Investing time and energy in regenerating monoculture landscapes at every scale is part of an important cultural shift. At the policy level and at the personal level, it can be a declaration of welcome, of inviting biodiversity back into our lives. For so long, Americans have striven to keep our landscape tidy and controlled in line with the strange, seemingly meaningless traditions of long-dead colonizers. Do yourself a favor, look up the weird aristocratic history of the American grass lawn. It's an invention of 17th century Europeans who simply didn't know what we know now about climate science or our place in nature. It's a vestige of an old, outdated attitude about plants, bugs, nature, that the non-human world is scary or gross or weird or dirty, primitive, brutal. It's time to cast off the idea that nature is unruly and has to be dominated, and that 300-year-old upper-class aesthetic ideas are still somehow relevant and worth the billions of dollars and countless hours they require to uphold. Instead, I hope we can approach land as an opportunity to start healing our relationship with nature. It's also time to set aside the fear that we have done too much damage, that nothing can be done, that insectageddon is inevitable. We are all guilty of doomerism, and narratives like insect apocalypse reinforce that. But we are only doomed if we hear these warnings and do nothing. We can start small. Starting small is almost always the first step to going big. By helping bugs in our community where we live, by paying attention and paying gratitude to the little things that support us, we assert that a better world is worth fighting for. And if you're looking for a point of entry into this regenerative, collaborative, compassionate care for the planet, well, might I suggest spending some time with people who grow food.
Yeah, so I came here for the community aspect. I think food brings people together more than almost anything else. And I've noticed with a lot of youth that we work with that there's just a really broken relationship between where your food comes from and how food affects your body. And I didn't grow up gardening, so like I could understand that. And this was all new to me when I first came. And so with youth particularly, just having them and exposing them to nature, to bugs, to wild things that taste good, and understanding how there's diversity there. So when they look at leaves and plants, when they're walking down the street, they can recognize, oh, that one's good for medicine, that one's good for food. Just nurturing that relationship, I feel like, is the first step to just instill that care for the environment and just observe what's going on around them. So, and that goes back to just that healing those relationships, because, you know, centuries and centuries ago, everyone knew all the plants, all the things. I mean, there was just not, there wasn't that broken relationship there. So with youth starting young in that way, and then with introducing like cooking and stuff like that, is just as they get older, it's just more in their repertoire. They feel more confident. And the kids we've been working with now for multiple years, they remember what we made the year before. They'll ask for it. They'll show younger kids. They'll make it at home. And like those small things, those ripple effects are huge. And it's really a privilege here in Garfield that we can be so local. We're not like a citywide thing. We're not a national thing. We are Garfield neighborhood. And we work with people from other neighborhoods. But with youth particularly, it's, you know, I live like a block away. It's kids I see when I'm walking. It's kids who, you know, walk by the farm on a daily basis. So you can really just develop those relationships and that trust. So that's particularly with youth. And then when youth involved, their parents are involved and other adults in their life. So that's an easy kind of connection piece.
Along those lines, can you talk about the importance of collaboration and community in the work that you do?
Yeah, that's, I think that's, I mean, that's key, right? So my background is social work. And then with being in Peace Corps, it was just hammered into me that if anything is going to stick and have value, it needs to be done with community. And it was really good having that training, just with Rwanda in particular, because it's slow work. But you know that going into it. And if you kind of train your eyes to see little things that happen, like, it's very encouraging along the way. And it's just a lot of little things. And those add up over time. And you kind of just look back one day and you're like, oh, you know, look at this. Like, now people know this place. Now kids are like telling their friends to come here. Now, you know, teenagers be up here like shooting TikTok dance videos. Like, you know, it just changes and it's great to see. And those like little things are huge if you know that and understand that. And so with that collaboration, it's worth it, I guess, just to take the time to get that feedback the whole way. And then you get like a lot of, I mean, buying is such like a, you know, word that's thrown a lot around a lot, but that's like essential to stay relevant and to make sure that the organization is actually serving, you know, people doing what it's supposed to do.
Okay, so I like this question. There's a lot of messaging on social media about individual actions that people can do to contribute to fighting climate change. Things like zero waste lifestyles and sourcing food locally. Can you talk about the difference between that and collective action?
Yeah. Tonight is Thursday nights. It's volunteer night. We have folks who come up here every Thursday to weed or to pull things, and I don't understand why they do it. Like, I don't know that I would do that. But they, to be a part of the group, to collectively do something like that and to understand the impact it has, even on a very small level, is such a hopeful thing. To do that while you're talking and joking is such a hopeful thing, of doing that in community and in collaboration. So I just think the collective act of doing something simple, it's just the benefits of it are so much bigger than you would expect. And so the individual acts, some people come on their own and do stuff as well, but all those things add up collectively on the farm. But there's just something really special about working with people and the hope that that brings, even if it's, yeah, like an easy thing like tearing out knotweed, which is one of our worst invasives. And some people, that's just what they do. They come and weed knotweed, or come so that our main wall is clear of weed, so that when people walk by, they can read the signs that the kids made, because that makes people happy when they walk by. So food is great. The farm is great. Those things are happening because we're here, the farm, but it's really just about being with people and doing something beneficial.
When thinking about facing a problem like climate change, what strengths does your community have?
Yeah, when facing climate change, so Garfield neighborhood is a very family-oriented neighborhood, and it is changing. There's a lot of gentrification happening and a lot of new faces in the neighborhood. But then there's also lots of homeowners and families who have been here for generations, and they're really close-knit and tight with each other. And I think having that strength of community is one of the best things moving forward with climate change, because your neighbors will help you, will bail you out. If you need a place to stay, if you need food, like having that social, I guess, network is going to be, I think that's going to make a huge difference. And I think a lot of people saw that with COVID when it hit and we're supposed to be isolating. And I know for me personally, like with my friend groups, with the family groups, the folks who seemed to be most resilient were the ones who had strong relationships with their immediate neighbors or like a community that was local. And I think that's going to be the same thing with all that's going to happen. All the many things that will come because of global warming and climate change is just having strong relationships with where you live. And there's a lot of folks in Garfield who do grow their own food and who know about that. There's a lot of openness to like bartering and exchange. There's a lot of resilience because it is a neighborhood that since the 60s has been primarily African-American, and just being able to operate under the like mainstream of doing stuff brings you resiliency, brings you creativity and how you economize and do all that and your relationships and how you network. So those are all going to be strengths.
What are your hopes for your community, maybe for this area in the next however many years?
Just like my general hopes for the neighborhood?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I am a resident of Garfield. I am a member. My home church is in Garfield. Both my husband and I work in Garfield. We love this neighborhood, and we're very lucky that we can, our lives are so small and like provincial. And I think because of that, like we are very tied to the health of Garfield. And our hopes, we both work with youth. My husband's a teacher. I work with a lot of youth at the farm. Is the safety of the youth and youth just having opportunities to engage in ways that are gonna empower them and lift them up. And the farm is one of those things that we can work with youth and as like we're trying to make the farm more and more of just a community green space that folks wanna be at. And that's a healthy thing, always to have a safe green space where you can eat lunch, where you can bike, where you can walk around. So just that, the overall health of the neighborhood being tied to this and the green space of there. But just in general, with gentrification happening, there's a lot of, not fear or anxiety, but a lot of hesitancy in how to move forward with our organization and how to honor old residents and new residents and moving forward. But with all that change happening, I think my hope is that there can be a lot of cohesion that comes between neighbors, new and old, as we move forward again, because I think that makes our neighborhood much more resilient in challenges that come. So just closer relationships and healthy outlets for youth to engage in would be the biggest hopes.
Many thanks to AJ, Israel, and all the folks at Garfield Community Farms for the excellent work that they do. You can learn more about that at garfieldfarm.com. Thanks also to D.I. Batad for their field reporting on today's episode. And of course, thanks to Ty G. Nelson, Sloan McRae, Nicole Heller, Sierra Christ, and Bonnie McGill at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. The music in today's episode was made by two of my most talented friends, Mark Mangini and Amos Levy. They also made the soundtrack for the We Are Nature video companion series, which we'll link to in the show notes. Until next time, here's some wise words about kinship and action. The United Nations says that climate change is nothing less than code red for humanity. It is already brutalizing many of the places we come from and rely upon. It is driving us apart, making us forget that we are not just interconnected, but interrelated. We are all kin. And if we're not careful, climate change is going to make us forget who we are. Animals of remarkable intellect, capable of immense care and compassion, even when grave injustice has laid us low. So, my message to you is simple. Remember who you are. remember that you have many relatives, human and non-human. And remember that we all come from somewhere, and that those places and the place called Earth need us to fight for them. That was Julian Brave Noisecat from his essay, How Indigenous Peoples Are Fighting the Apocalypse, in Emergence magazine. I've been and hope to remain your host, Michael Pisano. Thanks for listening.